afternoon, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Organic View Radio Show. Our podcast is available on iTunes, Zune, and all major podcast providers. You can also visit our website at www.theorganicview.com, where you can subscribe to our newsletter to find out about upcoming guests, features, events, and other shows on our network. If you have any questions or would like to find out about sponsorship opportunities, please visit us on Facebook, Twitter, or send us an email to questions@theorganicview.com. Hello, everyone. In this special series called The Neonicotinoid View, my co-host Tom Theobald and I will be joined by Dr. Brian Eitzer from the Connecticut Agricultural Experiment Station about his research entitled The Role of Pesticides in Honeybee Decline. According to the EPA's definition, a pesticide is, quote, any substance or mixture of substances intended for, preventing, destroying, repelling, or mitigating any pest. Though often misunderstood to refer only to insecticides, the term pesticide also applies to herbicides, fungicides, and various other substances used to control pests. Under United States law, a pesticide is also substance or mixture of substances intended for use as a plant regulator, defoliant, or desiccant. In the world of agriculture, and especially in beekeeping, neonicotinoids have maintained the spotlight as the scientific evidence continues to grow regarding the decline of the world's bee population. Neonicotinoids are defined by the EPA as a class of insecticides with a common mode of action that affects the central nervous system of insects, causing paralysis and death. All of the neonicotinoids were registered after 1984 and were not subject to registration. Some uncertainties have been identified since their initial registration regarding the potential environmental fate and effects of neonicotinoid pesticides, particularly as they relate to pollinators. So on today's show, we're going to be discussing this research with Dr. Brian Eitzer, and we're going to be talking about the research and how the honeybee health or the concerns, rather, of honeybee health, and also, just some other things that have been going on in the world of beekeeping. So I would first like to welcome to the show my co-host, Tom Theobald. Good afternoon, Tom.
Hello, June.
And our guest today, Dr. Brian Eitzer. Good afternoon, Dr. Eitzer.
Hello, June, and hello, Tom.
Dr. Eitzer, could you please tell our audience about yourself and why your team chose to pursue this research?
Okay, well, to start off, I am an analytical chemist, and so my expertise over the years has been in measurements of residues of various chemicals in the environment in all types of samples and different matrices. And a couple of years ago, several people started asking me about some of the neonicotinoids and can I measure these, and given some new instrumentation I had recently received, I was able to measure these compounds at relatively low levels in various types of samples and sample matrices that are interested and a part of the bee problems and related studies, and so I've gotten involved in research projects where some researchers are interested in particular aspects of these chemicals, need measurements of them, and so they're sending me samples, and I analyze the samples for them. And so my participation in most of these projects is as a chemical analyst measuring the various levels of these compounds.
Thank you. How long did the study take?
The particular study I think that you're currently referring to is a study that was published last year in the PLOS-1 journal, which is an open access journal on multiple routes of pesticide exposure to honeybees. And that was done over the course of a year, I believe it was about 2 years ago, of samples that were taken around a cornfield and what type of levels of pesticides we saw in some of those samples. And some of the bee products and stuff near those fields. So I believe it was basically done over the course of a year. pretty much, this particular sample and study. But
I've
been involved with various studies for a while, so when some of these studies are ongoing.
Of course. Now, can you explain the economic value of pollinators in agriculture?
I'm aware that they are very important to many aspects of agriculture, but the talking about economic value is not really my main expertise. Like I said, my expertise is in measurement of chemicals. But from things that I've seen, that they are, you know, depending on how you look at it, and if you can find the proper numbers, there is a an open one file here.
Tom, perhaps you could elaborate, since that is your forte, actually.
I've got a file here that was presented by Calderon et al. In 2012. Where they've looked at some estimates of the value of honeybees to U.S. agriculture, and the range in that value is somewhere between $10 and $20 billion that they've estimated of the value of honeybees to U.S. agriculture, and that's from a paper by Calderon et al. In 2012.
The most recent figure I've seen on that is about $18 billion, so it's slowly working its way up.
Yeah, this is a paper where they did some compilation of stuff, of studies from various times, and depending on exactly what parameters they looked at, it can range somewhere between, you know, in that range. $18 billion certainly sounds a reasonable number.
Dr. Reitzer?
Yes.
This is Tom. I have a question about the identification of the neonicotinoids. I've read and been told that it's a challenge to find the neonicotinoids, because the samples are fairly fragile. For example, they break down very quickly in the presence of light. Could you just explain a little bit about that for us lay people who may not understand the chemistry?
Sure. Most of my studies, I actually don't see very many of the breakdown products. And the reason for that is that the sampling technique and procedures that I use lose some of the metabolites, but I can at least see the native compounds at low parts per billion concentrations. So to give you an idea of what parts per billion concentrations are, when we talk about items in parts per billion, we're talking maybe teaspoons in swimming pools. Very, very low concentrations of these compounds can be present in the environment, so you need methods that are very sensitive. And the samples have to be taken properly, stored properly, frozen, and then shipped to me. So samples get shipped by an overnight shipping. I put them into the freezer until I analyze them. Some of the compounds supposedly have some breakdown in light, but others can be protected from light, and they, you know, have a little bit of persistence. I mean, certainly we have analyzed soil that has been present and gone back, you know, soil that has been analyzed from a year or two ago, and they still can see residues in the soil. So not everything breaks down and dissipates. The analysis process takes several days. You have to take the sample, you extract the sample, which means you remove the pesticides from the sample and get it into a solvent. So if you're dealing with a soil, you'll have to get into a liquid form. Then you take, excuse me, take the liquid, and you have to do some cleanup stages on the liquid to get rid of some other things that are extracted at the same time. If you think of a plant, you have pigments such as chlorophyll, and they can cause some interferences. You have to remove some of these other materials before you then put them on in your instrument. And I analyze these samples by something called mass spectrometry, or liquid chromatography mass spectrometry, which separates out the compounds, and then the mass spectrometer gives me essentially a fingerprint for a compound so that I have some unique identifier of a particular compound. In my case, I'm measuring the mass of the atomic weight of the compound and how it fragments, and then I take that peak that I get from the atomic weight and fragments, and because of the intensity of the peak, or how high the peak is, or the area underneath the peak, I can compare that to the same compound in a standard, and from that then determine what the concentration of that compound was back in the original sample. But it's a complex process, and the instrumentation is...
There has been a great concern about the persistence of these systemic pesticides in the soil and their migration in groundwater, Have you looked at those questions at all?
We have not looked at persistence in soil or groundwater at this point. Most of the samples that I've been analyzing for these compounds and related to bees are bee pollen, soils, some wax samples from the comb. In this particular paper that we were talking about here, we did look at dandelions. In some of our current ongoing studies, we're looking at the talc drifting off of the fields during planting. So we're looking at a wide range of samples, but we're not specifically looking at the persistence, which would require planting a field or placing it into a soil and then monitoring that soil for a long-term period of time without doing anything else in addition to do breakdown studies. That's a different type of study. Can be done, but that's not what we've been focusing on.
Are you aware of anyone who is pursuing those questions?
At this moment, no, but there are data for the breakdown of these compounds as part of the registration process where you can look up what the soil half-life is in a particular study that they did. But some of the issues with these half-life studies is that half-life of a pesticide in a particular soil can be very dependent on the conditions that that soil is maintained at and a local site, so that a soil in one set of conditions in one field might not be mimicking the same set of conditions in another site in another field, so that these studies are sometimes a little bit more specific, and so you're really just kind of getting an idea of the range of the persistence, but you don't know what the exact persistence is unless you're actually doing measurements in that particular field.
I have a question regarding pollen. I've gone over your slides in your PowerPoint, and one thing that jumped out at me was a table that you have that shows the incidence of occurrence, not necessarily the level, but the incidence of occurrence of various chemicals. And specifically what caught my attention was a very high level of incidence in alfalfa, now of imidacloprid. As far as I know, alfalfa is not seed treated. I'm wondering if you have any idea why that high incidence is occurring.
Well, I'm not sure which the particular. I've done a number of presentations you're talking about, but if you're talking about something with alfalfa, I think what you're referring to is a study that I was doing with colleagues here at the Connecticut Ag Station, and what we did was we sorted pollen from a incoming pollen trap, and so that as the bees came back into the hive, they dropped the pollen on the pollen trap. And
correct.
The title is
Selected Pesticides in Sorted Pollen.
Right.
Yeah.
So the selected pesticides in sorted pollen. So what this happened to be is this is a study that we've been doing where we've been following the same hive over the course of time, and I had one sample that had a very high level of imidacloprid, so that we were at the same hive, low, you know, we're sampling it every couple of weeks, and then I had a spike of, I believe it was about 70 parts per billion, and I can pull up probably the proper photo, so I'm looking at to give you what the exact numbers, and then it went back down low. I said, gee, you know, this one, what is the one jump here? What does this relate to? And I went back and I analyzed the sample again, and it still was high, and we looked at that particular pollen. And the pollen that came in on that day, so we're talking about a specific single day of pollen, not that it's a high incidence, and we're looking at the pollen from that one day, and the pollen that came in on that one day had many different colors. So that one day, there were orange pollen, brown pollen, yellow pollen. And so we said, well, rather than analyzing the pollen as a whole, let's try and sort this pollen out into different colors and analyze the different colors separately. And so we analyzed the different colors of that pollen coming in separately, and that's where one of the particular colors had some very, very high levels of imidacloprid.
Right.
And then where we said, okay, well, what is that type of pollen? So we sent those samples off to someone who does pollen analysis, and they told us what they thought that might have been the source. We don't know that for a fact that these are the sources, but this is what we thought the sources of the pollen might have been coming from. So if it was the one pollen that was high from potentially from white clover, it could have been that somewhere someone used imidacloprid that one particular day on a field that got caught with white clover, and then the bees were feeding that day and bringing that back. So that particular pollen from that day was very, very high because it had been related to a recent exposure event. But
yes.
I don't know where that particular field was, because obviously the bees can be collecting from many different places, as you can see from the different colors. So we don't know the exact usage. We just know that it seemed to be that that particular day on that from that hive, you get a real spike. And that's one of the things that a lot of the studies that I've been doing show, is that it's very variable what comes back to the hives. It's what's coming back, you know, the bees from the same apiary. I have in another study that bees from five different hives sampled from the same apiary the same day have very different colors in their pollen. And
yes.
Because they have different colors, they have very different pesticide levels in their pollen. So it's very specific to where the particular bees are out foraging and what fields are they on and where are they coming back from. And also, it's also somewhat specific to time of year. So in the springtime, farmers are using, you know, herbicides getting ready for the field planting. In the Midwest, they're using atrazine and getting things ready. So you can see some signature of time of year correlating with what pesticides are being used that time of year, what part of the country are you in, so what pesticides are being used in that part of what part of the country. And it's a very, very variable input depending on where you are. So, you know, you can't give a generalization of
sure.
This pollen has this pesticide, because it all depends on usage and where the honeybee hives are located.
Beekeepers are very familiar with that, and I go far enough back to the days when we had spraying and very serious bee kills, and in a bee yard of 20 or 30 colonies of bees, you might have a severe kill on some and a relatively moderate kill on others because they're foraging in different areas. The reason I asked the question about alfalfa is because that's a major honey crop in the West, and if that's being contaminated, it's cause for great
concern. That particular study was something done in Connecticut, and so Connecticut is a very, you know, suburban type state, and like I say, that was just a single shot. That's the only time we did a pollen analysis, so I would assume that we had plenty of alfalfa coming in other times, and that was one of the highest composite samples of imidacloprid that I had, so that was the sample that we chose to look at. And
yes.
When we separated that out, I would say that in general that's not probably the case, but if you look at anytime you look at a specific high one, you're going to find high levels because that's where you focused in on. And, you know, that was the sample of most interest.
Sure. Did you speak recently at the annual convention of the American Beekeeping Federation?
I attended the convention of the I didn't speak at the ABF, but in conjunction with the ABF, there is the American Bee Research Conference, which was held at the same time. And I participated in that. I wasn't speaking, but someone was talking about some of my pesticide research as part of the Coordinated Agricultural Program Stationery Project, which was a USDA-funded project where they were collecting a major load of data from seven stationery apiaries located around the country. And this is a study where we're trying to do a case studies following hives treated the same way in Maine, in Minnesota, in Washington, collecting a whole host of parameters, hive health, varroa mites, viruses, Nosema, and one of the other items they're following in these hives is pesticides. So they're collecting pollen and wax and sending these samples to me, so I'm getting pollen once or twice a month from each of these apiaries to analyze, and we're getting wax at the end of the study, and we're trying to correlate some of the pesticide information with all this hive health information that they've had from this several years of monitoring.
Do you know if the proceedings of that meeting are available to the public?
The proceedings will be of that meeting will be available to the public, though it will take a little time to get out. So I assume that paper will be, at least the abstract of that paper will be in the proceedings. Also, this CAP project is kind of concluding, so over the course of the next year or so, we hope to get out some final reports about the project and get out some papers about this big monitoring study that went on in the whole 4 years of the project, and that hopes to be written up sometime within the next year.
Do you have other future studies in mind that you're working on?
We're continuing on with some various studies. One of my current collaborations is with Dr. Christian Krupke at Purdue, where we've been monitoring, interested in how much of the clothianidin or thiamethoxam that is present on the seed coating can make it off-site during a planting episode in corn. So what Dr. Krupke is doing is he's planting corn that has neonicotinoids coated on the seed, and around the fields where he's doing his planting, he sets up small little slide glasses with a sticky substance on it, similar to, let's say, flycatcher paper. And he sets these slides out during his planting procedure at 0 meters, 10 meters, 50 meters, and 100 meters, and at the four cardinal directions around the field, so at both north, south, east, and west, does his planting. At the end of the planting, he then goes back out and recollects those slides, and he's been sending those slides to me for analysis of what is present on the slides that got, obviously, that turned up during the course of planting. And so we're currently analyzing those slides, and that study will continue for another year, and we're just finishing up getting the first year's worth of data from that study.
That was done this last planting season?
That was done this last planting season, and there will be a second round done this coming planting season.
And just out of curiosity, with the fields that were used, had there been any treated seeds planted there prior?
You would have to check with Dr. Krupke on that. Those are his fields, and
sure.
I don't know what the history on the fields are. I just can tell you on the analytical side. Another study that we have ongoing is we have a crop study where we're looking at the pesticide levels in cranberries, blueberries, squash, and I believe apples as part of a pollination study where it's a specialty crop grant where they're looking at the efficiency of pollination, what level of pollination occurs, how well various fields get pollinated, and again, collecting a host of data. One of the factors that they're going to be looking in these data is what level of pesticide use is on these different fields, and the way they're monitoring that is they're trying to collect samples of bees, both native and honeybees, so depending on what type of field that collecting samples and pollen, and again, analyzing the pollen. They're also looking at what the growers are applying in the fields and trying to see if the level of pesticide use at all relates to how efficiently the plants get pollinated as well. So that's another study that's ongoing, and that's a five-year study, and we're just into the first year of that. So we have a couple different things that are ongoing and continuing, different types of studies of various pesticides and pollen, and various other people are asking me about doing some samples for them. Like I say, I tend to be a resource for people who are interested in studying this because I have the capability of analysis of these compounds at such low levels.
Thank you. Can you talk about your work with the, I think it's the North American Pollinator Protection Campaign?
I have not done too much with the North American Pollinator Protection Campaign. I'm not sure what you're referring to. Some people involved that might have sent me samples at some point as part of some of the various research projects that I'm involved on, but I'm not really majorly involved with that.
Are there any research programs that, or rather, is there any research that you are working on that you would like to receive additional funding from, perhaps from some of our audience members who are very interested in the research that would love to participate and lend their support?
Well, like I said, all the various projects I'm involved on do need support, and the problem is, you know, for a lot of the people who are interested in studying pesticides, is the cost of pesticide analysis. These compounds are, you know, A, we want to see these compounds at low levels. B, to do this requires instrumentation that costs several hundred thousand dollars per instrument. And so because of that, the cost of samples ends up being between $200 to $300 per sample to be analyzed. So it is a you know, cost item that does play into a lot of what we can do study-wise.
Where has your funding been coming from?
The funding that we're getting right now is we get funding from the USDA through the CAP project. We get some funding from this other grant, which we just got, the Specialty Crop Research Initiative. My lab also gets some funding from the FDA for some other items that we do on food protection and pesticide residues. My salary itself is paid by the state of Connecticut because I am a state employee and on permanent funds. We also get some hatch grant funds from the USDA. So it's whatever agencies we can get to support our research is who we go after. But that's currently where our primary funding for these studies are coming in.
And, do you have adequate funding to continue what you're doing?
Do I have adequate funding? Right now I have – it's always – more funding is always, you know, good. We always – that's one of the biggest jobs of a scientist right now is continuing to chase the research dollars because it's a high competition for funding. And often you think what you have is a real good research project that you'd like to do, and it doesn't get funded. So this specialty crop project that I mentioned, we tried pitching two or three different times, and they'd say, no, it's good, but you need to do this a little bit different. And finally, after about three or four pitches, we finally got it funded, and now you can go forward for a couple of years. So it's a major effort to get funding and to continue getting funding. And with the federal budget climate being what it is, that only gets harder and harder.
Yes.
Dr. Eitzer, thank you so much for coming on the show today. It's been very interesting to learn about your research, and we wish you all the best in you in your efforts to continue the research, which is so incredibly important to everybody.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yes, on behalf of the beekeepers, I thank you as well.
Well, like I said, I've found it a very interesting avenue of research. Up until, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, I really didn't have much to do with bees, and now I'd say a very good portion of my, most of my research efforts are on stuff related to bees, so a good 40 to 50% of my effort. I do have other responsibilities as a state analyst for official samples and one other area of research that I am involved in, but a major portion of my efforts goes into pesticide issues as related to honeybees, so, and I find it a fascinating area.
Well, thank you for taking the time to talk to us and answer our questions.
You're welcome.
And folks, thank you so much for tuning in. This has been June Stoyer with the Organic Bee Radio Show. Have a great afternoon, everyone, and thanks for tuning in.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.